Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Well, Sean, it's been a long time.
Oh, don't you dare say how long.
Don't worry, I won't. How have you been?
Super as always. And might I add, Brian, it's good to see you after all this time.
Oh, thanks, Sean. It's been a long absence.
Yes. Well, abscess makes the heart grow fonder.
Listeners may have been wondering where the hell we've been all this time. Maybe there are some new listeners who have never listened to this podcast before, but I suspect that we have now become a legacy act. What do you think?
Well, like Mariah, you know, we don't have to produce brand stonking new amazing hits, but she has recently, and we can too.
Well, Sean, we have been absent from the airwaves and from the earbuds for basically one entire year. Was it a very good year for you?
Yes. Well, you know, our relationship really went from strength to strength since we stopped doing this podcast.
Yes, I think the health of our relationship was inversely connected to the amount of episodes that we were releasing. I'm sorry, loyal listeners. I know that many of you wrote to us. You asked, where has Broad Appeal been? If we get a great response to this episode, who knows? You may be able to pull us back in.
And for the really sharp-eared superfans, if you listen closely, you'll tell in the editing where we had a fight.
Yeah, so we're not going to explain why we've been away. We kind of burnt ourselves out a little bit in the past. But of course, we couldn't let a year go by without some commentary on the Oscars. And so, of course, Sean, as is our usual habit for several years running, we are here sitting down at the microphone, and we are going to work our way through all of the female nominees, because we look at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past, am I right?
Not today, I'm afraid.
Not today?
Not today, Brian.
But why?
I'll tell you why. In this very special episode, we're going to be talking about the...
Wait a minute. Are you saying we are going to go through with an entire Oscar episode of Broad Appeal and we are not going to discuss the categories of Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress, but they're the only two categories we ever care about?
Yeah, normally.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, we're sorry, you know. It's 2020, it's a new decade. Sean and I are still very female-driven in our general movie-going habits, but this was not a vintage year for women at the Oscars, okay? Shout out to Mary Kay Place.
Yeah, shout out to Jennifer Lopez.
Shout out to Alfre Woodard.
Yeah.
Yeah? Nowhere to be seen. Lupita Nyong'o.
Where are you, babe?
Yeah. Well, I think they all were knocking on Oscar's door, and he was not opening. I mean,
no.
J-Lo and Shakira, at least, will get to triumph at some sports event that I've heard of occasionally. Yes. They had every chance to nominate some incredible performances. And let's admit, you know, there are your Florence Pughs in there.
Yeah, there's your Saoirse Ronans, there's your Little Women, films that we... Yeah, full-heartedly endorse and enjoyed.
Yeah. And there are people for whom I'm very happy to see, like Laura Dern, presumably, is going to win an Oscar, and who could dislike Laura Dern?
Yeah, even Kathy Bates is there. We're not going to see Richard Jewell, but we are happy for her in
I'm
her own way.
I'm always happy for Kathy Bates.
Yeah.
But ladies and gentlemen, let's be honest, we could not summon up the interest to record an entire episode of this quite tepid and subpar year of female nominees. And Sean, do I need to get out my soapbox here for a minute or something? Because there's another topic that we just really need to address.
Oh, is it Renee Zellweger? Now, I'm going to go to the bathroom while you talk into the mic. Let me know when you're done.
The bathroom is the right place to be when you're talking about Renee Zellweger performing as Judy Garland. And how do I know? Because I have not seen the picture. Now, Sean, I've had no forum because we've had no episodes in which to decry this situation. But listen, I'm sure Renee Zellweger in her own way is a very nice person, okay? The woman has an Academy Award and she has been nominated numerous times. I'm sure she's been through some personal and professional difficulties in the years since she won for Cold Mountain. I don't begrudge her a comeback narrative, but let's be honest, the way that this woman has sort of cakewalked toward what we all presume is going to be a Best Actress win for playing, impersonating, like putting on the wig of Judy Garland is disturbing to me. It's fundamentally against my religion and it's heresy.
Yeah, and as you say yourself, Judy was robbed from winning her Oscar for the greatest female performance of the 20th century in A Star Is Born.
Well, certainly the greatest female performance that includes music. I mean, you know, if we're talking Oscars, I might say like Scarlett O'Hara, Vivien Leigh is at the pinnacle. But let you know, Judy Garland is the greatest entertainer who's ever lived.
Yeah, and right? she, even though she's a juvenile Oscar, never won a competitive one. And it looks like that Renee Zellweger, of such classics as, you know, Cold Mountain,
is Nurse Betty.
Nurse Betty. Not to mention Miss Potter. she's going to get her second Oscar, and it's going to be a Best Actress one. And, you know, but this is the way the cookie crumbles, the dice lands.
But listen,
get vintage years and you don't get vintage years.
Sean, but no, this is of another order, okay? There are wins that I have not been happy about, you know, that have been preordained. Like, on no planet did I ever need to see Natalie Portman win for Black Swan. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, but she's the young up-and-coming person of the moment. Here is what I disagree with, okay? Like, I get that there's maybe an interesting meta level on which Renee has been a person who's out in the wilderness, and here she is returning and playing Judy in her, like, last years, last moments when she's supposedly still running on fumes, okay? And if that trailer is any... I mean, do you remember the reaction that I had when we were in the cinema
and
the trailer
came on? Yeah, I thought it was an overreaction, to be honest.
And why is that?
Well, because, Brian, like, people who I admire and respect have said the film is good and she's very compelling in it.
No, they've not said the film is good. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard it here. I will never vote for Pete Buttigieg in any election, and I will never see Renee Zellweger in Judy. Why? Because I'm a self-respecting, card-carrying, old-fashioned homosexual. I like my queers radical, and I'd much rather sit at home and listen to Judy at Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
Okay?
Well, just to wrap it up, you know, Renee Zellweger has always done a very good job of being miscast in everything that she's been in. And I think arguably you could say that as Bridget Jones, she is quite good. But again, she's miscast because she's some, you know,
corn-fed
Texan playing this homely girl from the home counties, you know. And even in Cold Mountain, it's like, I think she's supposed to be some kind of hillbilly, you know.
Cold Mountain allows her to let her freak flag fly. It's at least a compelling performance. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense in the movie.
And obviously, you know, in Chicago, she couldn't really sing or dance. But then again, is Roxy ever supposed to be able to sing or dance properly?
Yes.
Okay,
listen. Gwen Verdon.
I'm not getting into this anymore, okay?
Okay, but here's what I'm going to say. The decision to release a trailer in which the soundtrack is Renee Zellweger singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I mean, you know, Judy starred in Judgment at Nuremberg. I think she knows something about war crimes, okay? I watched the Golden Globe speech. Maybe there's a level on which this is like some strange performance art, yeah? Where Renee appearing with this strange resentment and kind of weird punch-drunk quality, like, ought to remind us of Judy's, like, late-in-life appearances on the Jack Parr show. But, like, to me, that speech was so strange and uncomfortable, I kind of was, like, comparing it to James Mason in Star Is Born when he's, like, completely drunk and out of it at the Oscars. Like, listen, it may sound like I'm dumping on Renee. I can't deal with it. I would be perfectly happy if this was a nomination. Give her a comeback nomination. Let her be in other movies. But the problem is, because this is such a non-vintage year for women, she's going to just easily sweep to a second Oscar, and it's undeserved. There, I've said it.
Okay, I'm having the last word on this, okay? 2 points. One, Glenn Close. Two, tits pervert. Now let's move on.
Well, we needed to get that out of the way. But that's not the only reason that we're focusing on the actor and supporting actor categories in this very special episode. I think it's because they're basically one of the best crop of male acting nominees that we have ever seen in our lifetimes.
Yeah, we could make up our fantasy football league of like best actors who, you know, to put in any category. But fact of the matter is, We have 10 brilliant actors here, all of them stars in their own right, many of them with Oscars, many of them deserving of Oscars, some of whom will get Oscars, but not everybody, obviously. You know, when you look at the films themselves feel so much weightier than the categories of the women, unfortunately. And it just so happens that, like, you know, we love these guys. I think every one of them we have our own kind of fond connection and affection for.
In a way. I mean, I think the thing is, normally you and I, like, literally zone out, right? Especially in recent years with supporting actor and actor.
Oh, like, yeah, we were thinking about this, weren't we?
If we just ran back through, like, Winston Churchill, Freddie Mercury, Stephen Hawking, I mean...
Dallas Buyers Club.
Oh, I mean, both actively categories made me break out in hives, yeah. Right? It's really hard to, like, think back to male wins that I even could, like, wrap my head around. Like, I remember when Mahershala last year won second Oscar. Like, it was hard to hate on Mahershala. But even he in that win seemed to be hating the fact that he was winning.
God, Green Book was only 1 year ago, wasn't it?
Need I remind you that Christoph Waltz has 2 Oscars. Sean is dumbstruck. Now, granted, the first one was deserved. But what I'm saying is, for whatever reason, the men who get nominated year on year seem to be these grizzled, you know, kind of uninteresting biopics, or they're some young upstart who, you know, happens to catch the moment, yeah. And kind of in films that have zero interest to us.
Yeah.
And this year, these 10 roles, with, you know,
with a couple of caveats,
with variation. Yeah. One of the interesting things is that these roles are rich and fascinating to discuss. Now, of course, there was a whole number of men who were not nominated, but when you think about, let me advance some theories to you about why this selection of 10 is so interesting, right? Most listeners may think of this as a female-driven podcast, and it is for the most part. But if you look back into the annals, you will find we did an entire series of sort of questionable masculinity or fluid masculinity.
Yeah, we called it the male gaze because that's what we were kind of taking a riff on. Depictions of the range of masculinities that has kind of snuck into Hollywood cinema by and large. And we did everything from Cruising to the Rocky Horror Picture Show to
Ed Wood, Dog Day Afternoon,
Red River.
Yeah.
Like, it was a very rich group of films, you know?
If you haven't gone back to listen to that, that was the last time that we really dealt with men in depth.
And actually, you and I love talking about men.
We love talking about men. Yeah. We love watching men, thinking about men, but I think particularly what we love is these kind of films that deconstruct masculinity. Yeah. And need I point out that on that male gaze series, 2 of those films that we covered featured
Al Pacino, yeah,
who we might think of him now as a grizzled old ham.
Yeah, stick a fork in him, honestly.
But he's not. Like, Al Pacino is an extraordinary actor and one who's had this amazing sexual fluidity. So I'm going to advance a couple of theories. I'm going to say that this is primarily across the board a really stellar lineup. And what's really fascinating is that within this list of 10, we have these really interesting and multi-layered homosocial relationships.
Yes.
Like, I haven't crunched the numbers. I don't know if we go back in time how many years have so many best actor and supporting actors from the same film.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we've got 3 couples, Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce in The Two Popes. We have Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And of course, we have Joe Pesci and Al Pacino in The Irishman. It's interesting, these kind of dyads. Across those 3 movies, we have these 2 male roles that kind of exist as a couple, as mirrors of each other, as complements to each other. It makes the whole analysis of masculinity across these 2 categories fascinating.
Your style and your methods are entirely different to mine. I don't agree with any of most of the things you say, think, or do, but...
Be an actor?
No, I'm a stuntman.
Stuntman. That's way better.
Why is that way better?
Actors are phony.
No.
They just say lines that other people write and pretend to murder people on their stupid TV shows. Meanwhile, real people are being murdered every day.
Still, they don't love the night. You charge a guy, always charge a guy with a gun. With a knife, you run away. You run away from a knife. So you charge with a gun, with a knife, you run.
That's right. Hey, you can do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a blanket, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
Rip.
Yeah.
I don't dig him.
Things have gotten out of hand with our friend again. And some people are having serious problems with him.
Why do the presidents of America and Russia and China come to you? Because, unlike them, your authority comes from the fact that you will suffer and die in the job.
I never waited for anyone who was late more than 10 minutes in my life.
I'd say 15. 15, right?
No, 10.
All right, messenger boy. Deliver my message. Give me evil, sexy Hamlet. Set him to do it. Enjoy it. And cut!
That was the best acting I've ever seen in my whole life.
Did we ever really think that in 2020... we were going to see Al Pacino nominated for another Oscar? You know, Al Pacino is a legacy actor at this point. Joe Pesci was retired. Anthony Hopkins is...
on another planet.
Yeah, like, really. But and it kind of restored your faith in these actors as well, because both Hopkins and Pacino and even Pesci, long after Goodfellas, kind of became, like, hammy and ropey and, you know, couldn't really rein themselves in. And he's kind of restoring the fact that actually these people we believed in are still incredible actors.
Now, here's the thing, Sean. Can I play the devil's advocate for a minute here? Okay, and you can defend. Because I agree with everything you're saying. But I think there's a devil's advocate position, which you may see on Twitter. You may see on, quote, woke Twitter, or definitely gay film Twitter of a certain ilk, that's going to be like, why are we interested in these old white men? They're clogging up the slots here. There are younger actors. There are a more diverse range of actors. Great that, you know, Pesci and Pacino have done so much. Like, are these really the best things that they're offering? Now, I think you and I can make the case for at least most of these nominations being really of interest. But here's my challenge to you, and this is a way to tee up The Irishman, which okay. is a film that I know you love. Tell me, a 23-year-old twink, why I should like The Irishman, a movie on Netflix that, like, I am clearly not going to watch when I could just go and watch the latest episode of Pose.
Okay, are you an intelligent twink?
I have the capacity to learn.
Okay, do you like stories?
Yeah, I love stories. I absorb them all the time.
Okay, well, first of all,
on my TikTok.
coming into any work of film and not being prepared to at least give it a chance is not a good idea.
Okay.
And second of all, you know, film in Hollywood, film in particular, is about myth-making. When you enter a Martin Scorsese film, you are being enveloped by one of the most intelligent filmmakers who has ever graced this earth.
Now, Sean, you are giving an answer that would go down very, very well, you know, at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, where the average age of audience members is going to be pushing 50 and 65, okay? But I'm a 23-year-old twink. I watch TikTok. Do people watch TikTok? But I watch things in short episodic bits. When you're saying to me cinema, I don't even know what cinema is. I like Marvel. I like...
Well, then I can't help you.
Okay, so is what you're saying that if I'm not into The Irishman, it's because I don't understand the slow joys of true cinema?
Okay, not quite. From an objective point of view about the idea of engaging with cinema at all, first of all, it's about kind of occupying the lives and realms of people that you've never experienced before, okay? I'm not a 50-something-year-old Italian-American gangster.
50?
But I can be. You know,
70.
He's 50 at one certain point in the film.
Yeah, apparently.
Okay, second of all, I'm not the average viewer either. I love film history. I love the various themes that appear in Scorsese's films. But if you ask me, why should I like The Irishman? Because it's a beautifully crafted, lengthy, you know, elegiac journey about a three-way love affair between three straight old men.
Okay, Now you've got me. Elegiac, I wasn't with you, but love affair between three old men.
Maybe you won't get it on the first reading of the film.
I think okay? I saw this on men.com a while ago. So you're really saying this? Are you give me the case. Who are the three men?
Listen, the first time I was watching the film, I was doing my very best to keep up with the plot and to identify who is this person, who is Jimmy Hoffa, all that kind of stuff, all right? Yeah. It's basically a story of three people. We have Frank Sheeran, who is an Irishman, played by Robert De Niro. We have Russell Bufalino, who's an Italian kind of like quiet gangster crook fella.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Jimmy Hoffa, who was America's Teamster union leader. Now, I didn't know what Teamsters were. Teamsters are just drivers and guys who do things out of trucks, isn't it?
You often hear, like on film sets, they refer to the Teamsters as well. They're often like the crew.
But that's what the film ultimately is about. You have Robert De Niro as this quite imposing in terms of physicality, but actually incredibly passive man who will do anything that these two men ask him to do.
The other two.
Yeah, until it gets to a point where he knows that one of his lovers has more sway and authority and can swing his cock bigger than the other one.
You've not made the case. Okay, so if I'm fast-forwarding through the movie because I have the attention span of a goldfish, yeah?
Well, I'm glad you're watching it at all, to be honest.
I know. I've got
TikTok twink.
I've got some Charlie XCX playing in the background.
You gotta stop talking because you're only embarrassing yourself. And me.
Anyway, so I'm fast-forwarding through and I'm saying, okay, that boy I like on Twitter, Sean, is telling me this movie has like a gay three-way, but I'm not seeing it. Basically, I'm seeing Robert De Niro with his like face looking like in some weird uncanny sci-fi. So what scenes am I looking for, Sean, that are going to show me this homosocial bonding between Pesci or Pacino and De Niro?
It's the scenes in which, you know, either one of those actors gets Robert De Niro by himself. First of all, you know, in a different kind of movie, the scene in which he meets Russell Bufalino is in itself a pickup.
It's a meet cute.
Okay. So Robert De Niro is having issues with his truck. It doesn't really know how to fix it. Out of nowhere comes this guy who fixes it for him. He asks the younger man, Robert De Niro, what his name is, and he tells him. Robert De Niro asks for his name, and he gets nothing. Instead, he gets someone who kind of has a glint in his eye and is looking at him and sizing him up and saying, good to meet you. Where do you hang out? Okay, yeah, maybe I'll see you there sometime.
Kid.
He's been picked up.
Yeah. No, that's right, and I haven't thought of it that way. But you're absolutely right. There's a kind of cruising, dare I say it, a kind of flirting. Granted, the film is very weird because, you know, we know that Pesci and De Niro are 70-year-old men and they've been kind of digitally scrubbed to kind of seem younger. But actually, in a strange way, it gives it this weird kind of ghostly quality that's kind of really interesting because you kind of know they're old, but they're being young. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's like, the beauty of cinema. That's the verisimilitude. Like, I saw it in cinema. There was a couple of instances where I was like, oh, the light's not really hitting them that well.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I'm like, what age? Who cares what age they are? I believe this.
But you're right about that pickup. Like, imagine it with Robert Stack and Rock Hudson from Written on the Wind, which we covered in The Male Gaze. They're men drawn to each other. And he's drawn to the De Niro character because he's like, I can see something in this kid. There's something that I can use.
Yeah.
And then it's a kind of slow seduction. Do you want to talk about Pesci first as a performance?
Yeah, okay. So Joe Pesci won his Oscar for Goodfellas. And a lot of people of my generation would also know him for his role in Home Alone.
Of course.
Yeah. Like, you know, Joe Pesci was amazing when he had the right role. And he was embarrassing and annoying in every other thing. Didn't he ruin the Lethal Weapon franchise as well?
Quite possibly,
he did. He appeared in, I think maybe in the third and fourth one he was there.
Hot-headed, right? He is the iconic... That good, because you've finally seen Goodfellas, am I right? You hadn't seen it before.
No, I hadn't seen it before. So I've seen all those extremely violent scenes.
Yeah, but it's also like that role that he has in Goodfellas, that you think I'm funny? Am I amusing you? Am I a clown? Right, that scene where he then shoots the kid in the feet.
Terrible.
Yeah, it's awful.
And then shoots him dead in the next scene.
But you can see that is like the quintessential, showy, over-the-top, explosive scene that's made to win an Oscar. And he also, of course, is in Raging Bull with De Niro. So I feel like all of America thought they knew who Joe Pesci was.
Yeah, and in many ways, when we found out that Joe Pesci was going to be in a Martin Scorsese film, I think the reason a lot of people were wary about The Irishman initially is because, like, oh, here we go. It is a true legacy act. They're wheeling out Joe Pesci to be some angry Italian crook. Well, the result is far from it. And I think this is partly why he's disarmed so many people and partly why he's so good in the film. It's because Pesci has been given this incredibly quiet, thoughtful role, who is, in his own way, very funny at times, quite scary, you know, that's very sinister, and also sad and pathetic, like so many of the male characters are in this film. And I think what I love about The Irishman as a whole is that, and the reason why I love how long it is because we don't normally get our characters to become so frail and so useless.
It's a film about obsolescence and people who are past their sell-by date in a certain way.
Yeah, and normally they die or the film ends, but you know, in Scorsese's, they keeps on going
keeps
on.
Keeps on dragging on.
Yeah.
It's almost as kind of fixated on death and repentance as Silence was, the last Scorsese movie.
And I just think Joe Pesci is really, he does a lot by saying a little.
Is there a favorite scene, or I mean, you've mentioned the pickup, like how does that relationship with De Niro progress over the course of the film?
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, that they have this quiet mutual respect for each other for most of the film, but there's a scene kind of in the just over halfway through the film, which everyone has been long established at this point, and Robert De Niro is getting some kind of Teamsters Union award celebration, real fanfare. But after these two characters tell De Niro how important he is to them and how much they care about him, you know, Pesci gives De Niro a ring. He gives him a big gold, what do you call those things?
Like a signet ring?
Signet ring, that's it. A big ostentatious signet ring. And he says, you know, only three people in the world have one of these rings and one of them is Irish. And so it's kind of funny because, like, what he's saying is, I have this ring, somebody else who's important has
Harvey
this ring.
Harvey Keitel.
Yeah. But you're also getting this ring. Yeah. You know, imagine for a second that he didn't have that line, what it would mean for him to say, I'm giving you a ring that I have that nobody else in this world has.
Well, it's a proposal and it's a bond, right?
Yeah, because... and it does bond them. It locks them. It changes the narrative fully. At that point, you kind of wonder which... you know, where De Niro's, not loyalty, but where his love is really going to lie.
Well, he's got two masters in a way.
Yeah.
Because he's been brought into the world of the mob by the Pesci character, but he's kind of been told to be the right-hand man and bodyguard of Pacino. But as there's a falling out, Pesci is kind of luring De Niro back over to him and saying, when it comes down to it, you've got to be with me. But you're right. Upon rewatching that scene with the ring, it is such a marriage proposal. Or even weirder, it's kind of like almost like a renewal of marriage vows.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
it's kind of like
it is,
a remembering of like, we're the ones who established these vows so long ago. And if you remember, he gives him the ring, he puts him on, he asks it how he feels. And then he kisses him on the cheek.
He does, yeah.
Now, again, you know, you don't want to read too much into it. It is like Italian men and it's a thing that they do. But I don't think a lot of those things are accidental.
No. Yeah? In Scorsese film, nothing's accidental.
They spend so much wonderful time. I mean, I'm sure, you know, our 23-year-old twink friend was really bored by all those scenes where they're driving around in the vintage 70s car and they just look like old fogies in like, you know, Hawaiian shirts. But I loved all that. I loved that kind of slow movement. We don't even know where they're driving to or where it's going, but of course it's going to the moment when De Niro has to decide, am I sided with the one daddy that I have over here, or am I sided with who buys me nice things, or am I with the other daddy who, you know, I now am told that I have to kill? And that's really the kind of central crux that we're moving toward. The one daddy, of course, there's a lovely sort of detail. There's so many details in the movie, but like the dipping of the bread into the little glasses of wine.
Yeah.
You love that.
I love everything about this film.
We ought to do that. We ought to start dipping some nice Italian bread.
Oh,
into
no bread, Brian.
Oh, sorry.
No bread.
Sorry.
No carbs. Okay, now moving on to Pacino.
Well, yeah, you want to tell me about Daddy Number Two?
Yeah, so I love Al Pacino.
Who
but
doesn't?
At the same time, I'm also irritated by him in nearly all his recent things. Even Roy Cohn is a bit much for me.
Come on.
It is, Brian.
Also, that's not very recent.
Yeah, but it is. In terms of quality, it is.
Okay, I'm going to contend with that, but carry on.
So, the thing about Pacino is that late in life, Pacino is very, very, like, kind of just the same role in The Devil's Advocate. He's basically he's playing Satan in everything he's in. And it's just like, oh, geez, Al, just tone it down a little bit. Weirdly, with Scorsese as director and with a character like Jimmy Hoffa, he gets a chance to be flamboyant,
mm-hmm.
but also to be contained at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain kind of magic that has happened here. And Jimmy Hoffa, who, again, I really didn't know much about, and the film actually acknowledges this. They say young people today, they don't know who Jimmy Hoffa is. Yeah, they might know that he disappeared or something, but they don't know that he was the union rep of every single truck driver in this country, who was as big as Elvis, he was as big as the Beatles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He people loved and admired and worshipped him and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, this was really important for me to learn. I guess, like, I've also learned that Jimmy Hoffa is this kind of big, flamboyant, kind of Pacino-esque type as well.
Well, you came home, I remember, because yeah. you saw The Irishman without me for the first time, and we watched it again together. You came home like such an acolyte of Jimmy Hoffa. Now, let it be said, Sean is easily swayed by any kind of like cult of personality. Is that fair to say?
Not anymore.
Well, okay, but you have been in the past. So you came home saying to me, Brian, why did you never tell me what a bad person Bobby Kennedy was? And I was like, oh God, he's drunk the Teamster Kool-Aid.
I have.
I mean, are you for organized crime? Like being
no,
being
I'm for strong unions. I'm for strong unions. I'm for workers' rights and representation.
Okay.
Who isn't?
Okay. So, but there is something about the Pacino characterization of Hoffa that you, along with Anna Paquin, found to be the more seductive, pleasant, pleasing daddy. Like, he goes down smooth like an ice cream sundae. Because that's the interesting thing, right? It's like De Niro's daughter, mm-hmm. The Anna Paquin character, even when she's a little girl, she really likes
yeah.
Al more than Joe, yeah. right? As Al, as Jimmy Hoffa. Like, despite his kind of big boy caprice moments,
yes.
if anybody hasn't seen Dick Tracy, Pacino was Oscar nominated for that, and like that's a cartoon character.
Yeah.
This has those moments, right? Like these kind of moments of exasperation.
Yeah,
these moments,
hands in the air,
but
slamming the table.
The thing is, he's a politician, so he's often delivering these speeches to people. You know, if you got it, a truck brought it to you. And he's also yeah. not doing the Italian voice. He's doing this. I can't exactly do it. It's like this kind of. It's like a yeah, Chicago. It got these kind of Chicago sort of. Polak kind of inflections in the vowels on occasion. It's very
yeah, it's
weird.
Yeah, it's not that, but it is.
No, it's not that.
It's not that,
that
thank
was.
God. Otherwise, the film would have bombed. It is a slight exaggeration in the way we don't really expect of Pacino.
Favorite Pacino moments from the movie?
Well, there's lots, Brian. There's lots. There's that part where he's almost shot in the courthouse, you know?
Uh-huh.
And his like son knocks the guy down. And in that moment, he's like, he gives advice about what to do if someone pulls a gun or pulls a knife. And he's like, someone pulls a gun, you charge him. Someone pulls a knife, you run away. You know?
Gun, charge, knife,
run
you
away.
Run away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's those kind of things. And like, I sometimes worry that the older I get, that I'm going to turn into one of these characters a little bit.
What, you're
going
to be Jimmy Hoffa?
I'm not going to be Jimmy Hoffa, but I mean like, you know, this actually happens a lot of the time when I spend time in Ireland. When
mm-hmm.
I go over, I kind of come back and I'm a little bit more, I got to give the gab a little bit more, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is a movie yeah. that's very much about this kind of extended, nonsensical conversations,
yeah.
which...
And if you want one of those, I can give you five.
No, it's true. Because, like, you know, the conversation about the fish that's in the car, or there's various other things that people keep harping on, which I can understand in a more economical movie you might cut out, but that's not the
yeah.
movie that Scorsese is wanting to make.
No, and it's not the movie that I want to see either. I want to see these acting legends do amazing things next to each other.
I
want to be enthralled by incidental pieces of dialogue, you know. I want to laugh and be a bit nervous at the same time, and I think that's what this film gives you.
Pacino does have some extraordinary moments. Like, I think what I love is the kind of it's a kind of clown role in a certain way. Like, it's, and he somehow captures this thing that's both funny and endearing, even though he's totally self-aggrandizing. But he seems kind of sweet on some level.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he stands out amongst all the other hoodlums, right?
Yeah.
Is that, yes, I do think he ultimately believes in this idea of brotherhood and that we're out there for one another. And he's in his own mind, he's worked out that, like, getting in bed with the mob is a way of helping his working men brothers, yeah?
Yeah.
And you can see it in the sweetness with which he eats the ice cream. I love, like, how he gets on the case of the up-and-coming gangster Tony Pro about him coming to a meeting in Florida wearing shorts.
Yeah.
And there's that great moment where Tony Pro is, like, you know, in this kind of Sopranos-esque way, just kind of talking about, they're freezing their asses off in New York, and we got this great weather down here. And he's like, it's summer in New York. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. There's just this lovely exchange. And that I think that there's something about the way he plays Hoffa that, like, the things he's concerned about are, like, wearing shorts.
Mm-hmm. Being on time.
Being on time. I never wait more than 15 minutes for anybody.
Yeah.
It's just, like...
And just things that are patently not accurate.
Like, you can just tell the Pacino Jimmy Hoffa would be a nightmare to work for or hang around with, but you kind of also would find him, like, weirdly compelling in an idiosyncratic way. And that makes the sentiment when De Niro, the sort of mechanism of mob loyalty and his force to make a choice, pushes him to having to kill Hoffa, it actually is quite moving.
Yeah.
And that kind of long sequence where they're getting him in the car to the house where he's going to die is really, really sad.
Yeah, and like... You know, I think a lot of gay Twitter just hasn't really taken the opportunity to think about these characters and think about the films and the way this film in the way that we have. I'm sorry that, like, people have been getting so up in arms about the Anna Paquin character and the amount of dialogue that she has. I'm sorry, that's not an accident, you know? This is a film in which people, which a certain whole swathes of people are voiceless, and in particular his family. And the fact that whenever Anna Paquin's on screen, she radiates with the talent of an Academy Award-winning actress, and she's so effective, okay, when she does actually get to speak. You know, I think people are very willing these days to get sniffy about things that they truly haven't thought about or actually taken the time to explore.
Well, listen, I understand a certain critique of it's a very male-focused movie, and maybe there's not equal fanfare by Netflix given to any films directed by a woman. You know, I can understand that. Why aren't they giving this big splash to, you know, Atlantics, directed by Mati Diop, also a Netflix release?
I can tell you why.
Because it's a film from Senegal in Wolof and French.
Yes, that's why.
Okay, but, well, okay, then why aren't they financing more films made by women, et cetera, or with women in the lead?
Well, they are.
And those are all legitimate conversations to have. I think the thing is, aesthetically, it does totally make sense in The Irishman why Anna Paquin's character is given only those moments of intervention. If you want to talk about women in Scorsese pictures, I have a list for you.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you're bringing this up.
No, I do.
Because people will say to you, oh, Scorsese, he never had any roles for women. Now, listen, shut the fuck up and listen to this.
I have a list for you. Ellen Burstyn, Liza Minnelli,
Sharon Stone,
Sandra Bernhard, Lorraine Bracco, Kathy Moriarty,
Winona Ryder,
Barbara Hershey, Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that's a complete
Cate Blanchett.
Cate Blanchett. There you go. And a number of those women either won Oscars for those roles or were nominated. And I think actually if you compare that record to his contemporaries, you compare that to the roles provided by people the likes of Steven Spielberg and Brian De Palma and even Francis Ford Coppola, I suspect that you'll see that Scorsese is interested in kind of questions of masculine guilt and violence and all that stuff. But there are often some really amazing female roles at the heart of those movies.
Oh, Jessica Lange.
There you go, Cape Fear. Well done. Okay, so have we talked enough about The Irishman?
Yeah,
now,
I think we talked probably too much about The Irishman.
Well, I know you love it. Now, you mentioned Satan. Can I bring up another name to you? Joseph Ratzinger.
Oh, my goodness, Brian, that's a very guns blazing way to approach a person who is a living pope.
Do you reject Satan and all his works? He's a pope. Emeritus, Sean.
Emeritus Pope Benedict.
Now, we don't need to spend too long on the two popes, because I think it, in some ways it's the cinematic equivalent of fast food, perhaps, but it's enjoyable fast food nonetheless. Or are you going to...
It's the cinematic equivalent of unconsecrated communion wafer.
Do you know, you were a Catholic boy like me. Did you, before you ever had the host, did you, like me, think it was going to taste like a potato crisp, a potato chip?
No, I don't think wafers are a big part of American culture, but, you know, an Irish dessert would be a piece of ice cream that's cut, like a block of ice cream that's cut, and then you put a wafer on one side, and you put a wafer on the other.
I literally thought it was going to taste like a Pringle or something.
Really?
I was really disappointed.
Well, actually, we were allowed to taste them before communion.
unconsecrated.
Oh, of course, ovs. This is during a rehearsal.
Yeah, because if you happened to drop them, they would burn a hole in the carpet.
So these were just unconsecrated pieces of host, and we were allowed to nibble on them.
Oh, good for you. So, of course, as you can tell from this conversation, Sean and I are both Catholic through and through, even if we don't always go to church anymore, right? We will always pledge our allegiance to the one true church. As much as sexually active gay men can do that, yeah? So I think, in a strange way, again, this is yet another movie that our 23-year-old twinks on woke Twitter are, like, denouncing or don't even know exists. And yet, you and I were like, of course we're going to watch The Two Popes.
Yeah, I watched it on New Year's Day. I watched it on a hangover.
You know, The Two Popes, I put it in that category with movies like Philomena and... I don't know. There are other movies in that category that I think, or Florence Foster Jenkins, like the kind of Stephen Frears movie that gets you in recent years a couple of acting nominations for a beloved person and the audience that...
Yes, quasi-intelligent
it's,
fluff.
Quasi-intelligent fluff, and the audience is mostly your aunt, right? Like, you and I both have aunts who would love these kind of movies, you know?
Yeah.
Is this a great example of that? No. I have major issues with the fact that The Two Popes was nominated for screenplay. Apparently it's...
Oh God, it was,
isn't well, it? Apparently it's based off of the guy who wrote a play originally about a sort of fictionalized meeting between Benedict and Pope Francis. It does clearly betray its roots in a play. Like, that long central section where they're kind of with each other just feels like they're kind of talking at each other and delivering exposition in a way that no normal people ever really talk.
If you want to learn what exposition is, just watch The Two Popes. I mean, just you give some kind of things like, oh, well, you know, you remember during your upbringing in Bavaria.
Well, and it's also like, of course, they're both popes.
Yes.
You know, so they know everything about Catholicism. They say, well, of course, as you know, the doctrine will not allow us to do blah, blah, blah. Anytime people are saying, like, as you know, you're exposition clanger should be going off. But okay, so given all these things about the tediousness and the corniness of just like the whole setup of the movie, do you think that Anthony Hopkins and Jonathan Pryce acquit themselves well in these two roles?
Oh, very much so. Anthony Hopkins is actually quite a, I would think he's actually quite an avuncular, benign kind of, you know, entertaining figure. And you can only point to a few roles, such as things like, even Dr. Van Helsing is kind of ludicrous in a fun kind of way.
Yeah, he can really sink his teeth into things in a wacky way. I mean, you've still never seen Titus, the Julie Taymor one, where he is bonkers in that, along with Jessica Lange and some others.
I'm not watching any films produced by Stephen Bannon, thank you very much.
Oh, okay, God. Mm. Let's brush that aside. But so you're saying he turns Pope Benedict into an avuncular, jovial figure?
Yeah,
is that a good thing?
We all knew he was going to do this. Everyone, the moment I heard they were doing a film with Anthony Hopkins as Pope Benedict, I knew that you'd come away from that movie thinking, oh, Pope Benedict wasn't so bad.
I'm not sure if I agree with you on this, and we actually didn't watch the movie together. I think what you come across from the movie, and of course this meeting between Francis and Benedict never really happened. But I think...
They have met, though.
Well, yeah, of course they've met, but this particular meeting, the way it's described in the film, where Benedict kind of summons Francis in to kind of have this long discussion that kind of really seems to trigger Benedict's decision to retire, that's a dramatic construction. Like, I think that the way he presents Benedict is as a stiff... an arid person who has no connection to human emotion and no connection to the world, right? And for most of the length of the film, that's kind of the way it is. He almost plays him like as weirdly autistic, and I'm sorry if that's offensive to people, or it's like he doesn't pick up on humor. He doesn't relate to people in the same way. And so to the degree that it's funny, like it's funny to us in the audience, because the audience is clearly meant to relate to the warm, generous, humane Bergoglio, Bishop Bergoglio, who becomes Francis, right? And he plays Benedict Ratzinger like he's like some sort of alien who spent all his time like just combing over canon law. Do you know what I mean?
Never had pizza before.
Yeah, and never had pizza, and also like wears incredibly fancy shoes, and is just like wrapped up in the ritual. You know, so in that sense, it does conform to my image of Ratzinger. I think, like, if I had a socio-political and theological critique, it's like they do ultimately allow him to be a puppy dog. Like, it's like over the course of this interaction with Pope Francis, it's like he melts and he becomes sweeter, and then there's that like post-credit sequence where they watch the football together, and you're
kind of, how can you not love that?
Well, you can not love it if you think about the actual legacy of this man and the kind of ideology that he upheld, which, you know, has a very, very harmful sexual morality.
But Catholicism has a harmful sexual morality.
Yeah, but what I... Yes, Sean, and he, for decades, is the person who made sure that that was the case, right? Literally the...
Decades? Okay. I don't think so, decades. I think Pope John Paul did his own...
Sean, who do you think was Pope John Paul's Rottweiler? It was Ratzinger. That's what I'm saying. So,
yeah, but the Pope is infallible, so Pope John Paul could have made some decisions.
Okay, no. Ratzinger was in charge of the doctrine, whatever it's called, the Committee for the Doctrine of the Faith, for all of that time, and he was ensuring that like hardliners were put in place so that the legacy of Vatican II would be stifled, right? Okay. Because I'm talking from 1968, you had this chance for the church to move in a different direction that was going to be kind of more open and flexible, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying about Ratzinger. Like, he is the architect, along with JP2 and other bishops, of that. And like, now, granted, that's not going to make for a fun Netflix movie, right? It's going to be funnier to see a comical old man who, like, has his Fitbit, like, talking to him and saying, keep moving, you must not stand still, you know? And, of course, that's, again, a very heavy metaphor, you know, of his kind of stagnation. I think if I could lose any of these 10 nominations, I would probably lose Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, you're so mean.
But listen, I have affection for Anthony Hopkins. Anyone who's played opposite Emma Thompson that number of times can't be all bad.
Yeah.
And he makes Benedict... Yeah, funny and curmudgeonly. I love the fact that he makes very little attempt to make him sound German, but he does deliver Latin quite well.
Yes, he
and
does.
I have to say, this is a shout out to frequent listener Peter Cook, who when I was talking about the two popes with him, he was like, I was watching the movie and I thought, God, Anthony Hopkins makes a great job of making Ratzinger really look decrepit. And then at the end, they showed the real Ratzinger, and I realized how much further he had to go. I mean, he really does look like a walking corpse when they show Ratzinger. The actual footage.
Well, you know, he's still around.
I know he is. Yeah. Somehow, he's both infallible and
indestructible.
Unkillable. Now, I know there are a lot of people who were disappointed that Jonathan Pryce took one of those five best actor slots because maybe, you know, there were other people that they thought were deserving.
Who
thought that, or who else would be deserving?
Yeah, who else would be deserving?
People thought Adam Sandler. People thought Eddie Murphy. You know, there were a number of other people. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I'm sure we could start a longer list.
But I love Jonathan Pryce.
Well, that's the thing, too. I have such affection for Jonathan Pryce as an actor. He's been around for so long. He's such a wonderful character actor. He's been just so unsung for such a long time. Frankly, I thought he was great as Pope Francis. Like, and I don't think it's an easy role to play.
I really don't think so either.
Do you want to, like, what was your response to him?
Well, I actually think it's a much harder role to play. You know, if you're Pope Benedict, you get to be doddery, staid, but also like a puppy dog at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're Pope Francis, you kind of have to be Jesuitical, first of all. And you have to be both a believer in your faith, but also a kind of a believer in the fallibility of people. And it actually makes you a little bit more of a wet character to play.
Yeah, but he doesn't do that.
No, he doesn't. I mean, but he has to skate very carefully to it.
From those opening scenes where he's walking in the streets of Argentina and talking to people about his favorite football teams, and he's relating to the common people. Like, now, granted, the tropes within the screenplay are quite telegraphing to us, this is the way one man is versus this is the way another man is. But I think it's a star performance from someone who's often not the star, right?
Like, very true.
Jonathan Pryce is often not the star. He's often a supporting role or kind of a little schlemiel. Like,
or maybe, Juan Perón.
Yeah, Juan Perón. But Juan Perón is definitely not the center of that. I mean, think about it. Like, even a movie that he has the leading role, like Brazil, the star of the movie is more the system that he's fighting against. Yeah. He's still some little cog in a giant thing. Yeah. Whereas in this, he has to exude a kind of warmth, a kind of humanity. He has to be humorous. He has to be someone we can relate to and yet also consider saintly. And that's a hard thing to do. Yeah. I mean, I think back to when was the last time someone who was really saintly, like, got Oscar nominations? You know, you think of, like, Susan Sarandon as Sister Helen Prejean. It's a tough role to play without it coming across as sanctimonious.
Yeah.
I also have to give him credit, because when the movie started, I was like, I'm going to find this really ludicrous because they're all going to be talking in English the whole time. And the amount of Spanish and Italian that he speaks throughout the film is really impressive. I don't think it was dubbed.
No, it wasn't. He learned them all.
I mean, I'm sure a native speaker could critique the accent, but at least to me, it gave a kind of authenticity to the role that I thought was great.
Yeah, another line when he went, may I have a glass of water? He was excellent during that line. His English was perfect.
Can I say, what did you make of that scene, which I think is the controversial one, where we've been hearing them talk about all this stuff, and then when they finally talk about sexual abuse, like, the sound goes out, and we don't really hear what they're saying? Like, was that an aesthetic choice, or was that the filmmakers being like, the church might sue us for libel?
It's a different movie.
What do you mean? I feel like it's...
Like, it's a different movie because it's such an important... topic.
But isn't that the heart of the matter?
No, the heart of the matter is a kind of ecumenical tete-a-tete between two popes over Orangina.
Well, yes, but that's, I mean, arguably that's the ethical heart of the movie that they're sidestepping, even engaging with. But do you know what I
want? Yeah, well, the whole Catholic Church has ethically sidestepped that entire topic as well.
Yeah.
I'm not putting the burden on the filmmakers.
They give enough time to his, like, kind of guilt over the situation with the junta in Argentina.
Yeah, but something has to be a representative stand-in for the guilt he might feel in another situation.
Can I say one last thing?
Okay.
I really think that, you know, the real thing that was underplayed and underexplored is all about that butler. The Vatican butler. You know, the guy who, like, leaked all the documents. Like, where's his movie?
Oh, no, that little queen doesn't get any movie.
Mm.
No.
What does Gay Twitter have to say about
like
that?
We don't like her. Okay, that brings us on to a film that I very much enjoyed, but you loved. And I'm very open-eared for you to convince me once again why it was so good. And that film is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Thank you, Sean. So again, maybe I'm going to play the role of mansplaining to our apocryphal twink about why he should like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Dadsplaining.
Yeah. This is a bit of a different situation than your history with Scorsese, right? So is it fair to say that you're a major Scorsese fan?
Yeah, I am, but I didn't realize I was.
Well, okay.
I mean, I love The King of Comedy, I love Cape Fear, they're two of my favorite films.
Yeah, those are two of your favorite movies, and you love his film preservation work. There's others of his movies you love. I'm discounting Hugo and Shutter Island, as I think we all should.
And don't forget Kundun, of course.
Kundun's pretty good, and we even like Silence.
Yeah, well, that's us.
What I'm saying is, you and I are predisposed to really go for Scorsese. It's no surprise that we defend The Irishman. But I have to say, Tarantino, in recent years, has really rubbed me the wrong way. We went to see The Hateful Eight solely because of that Jennifer Jason Leigh nomination, and I was like, is this the depths to which Tarantino has descended? I had no interest in seeing Django Unchained. Kill Bill is a movie that, like...
It's very much my generation.
Yeah, stylistically, yeah. I can admire it, but it just doesn't speak to me. I'm that kind of cinephile... you know, kind of femmy guy who thinks Jackie Brown is the apex of Tarantino's work and could do without a lot of the, like, kind of boy stuff that just seems like wanking to me.
Mm-hmm.
So going into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I was really intrigued by the subject matter and the kind of setting, the kind of end of the studio era, and the fact that it was going to be kind of adjacent to all this kind of Hollywood lore. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering, how am I going to feel about all this? I'm also not particularly disposed at the moment to like Leonardo DiCaprio, I have to tell you. One of the main reasons being for his less than enjoyable collaborations with Martin Scorsese, if you ask me,
over the years. Yeah, that actually is fair.
Like, I think we should be glad for the digital aging, de-aging technology, because otherwise you might have had...
Half a Leonardo DiCaprio.
Half a Leonardo DiCaprio, half a J. Edgar at the end of the movie.
And the thing is, like, I know that DiCaprio is a great actor, but I, at least until I saw this one anyway, I'm like, please give me something which he doesn't just scowl his way through.
Well, that's the thing. So, okay, maybe we can start with DiCaprio and move into a reading of the film overall. I've always said that Leonardo DiCaprio was at his best when he was light and when he was comic. Either romance, when he was a heartthrob, I'm talking about all the way back to Romeo and Juliet, obviously Titanic.
Mm. Catch Me If You Can.
But Catch Me If You Can, yeah. One of the great, really sort of star quality kind of roles that he was in, or his teenage roles in like Basketball Diaries and Marvin's Room and these kind of things. As soon as he started feeling the weight of I have to take on super serious adult roles, I just got so tired of him. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
And we haven't seen The Revenant, we should say.
I think what's fascinating about his work here is that he is funny, and he is kind of the butt of the joke of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's my reading of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like The Irishman, it is a film about change, and it's a film about obsolescence. It's a film about a kind of masculinity that is kind of reaching its sunset. And it's the masculinity that's built around the Western, the Hollywood macho ideal, mm-hmm. the studio system. Mm-hmm. DiCaprio, as Rick Dalton, he's someone who could have been Steve McQueen, who could have been a big star. But even Steve McQueen is like the waning days of kind of male stardom in Hollywood, right? We're at 1968, 1969 in this movie. So the new generation of stars that are going to come through are going to be your Pacinos. They're going to be your Elliot Gould. You know, honestly, Elliot Gould was a huge box office star for a period of about 2 years in like 71, 72.
And then he was Monica's dad.
But what I'm saying is you got these kind of like weedy intellectuals, Italians and Jews, who suddenly are the go-to men for Hollywood roles
in the 70s. Did you say Dustin Hoffman? Yeah.
Yeah. So what I love about Tarantino's take on this is he takes us into a kind of Hollywood world that is like adjacent to top-tier stardom, right? He literally lives next door to the hottest director in town. He works on cheap Western knockoffs. He's like filming a pilot as the villain, right? And we kind of see his desperate desire to be more relevant. Like, I watched the film with you in the cinema on film, not digital. And I then watched it again, actually, on the plane when I was flying back from the USA from my holiday trip. And I thought, I'm not going to find this movie enjoyable on the small screen. I don't know how much of it I'll watch, but I was immediately drawn into it again. And I think the thing that I just connected with is like, DiCaprio, he plays a tough guy. It's a lot of the film is about appearance and reality. Like, he plays this tough guy, but he's like a wimp, and he like whines and cries because he's not gonna get a particular part. When he has that meeting with Pacino, who is his agent, Mr. Schwartz.
Oh, he's in it.
Remember,
too.
Mr.
Totally
Schwartz,
forgot.
And sadly, the
Brenda Vaccaro was supposed to be his wife.
Well, she's in briefly in it, but I think
the back of her head is.
Her main scenes appear on the cutting room floor, but according to the Marc Maron interview, there may be some extras in the DVD and Blu-ray release that include more of Pacino and Brenda Vaccaro. So he leaves that scene when talking to his agents, like, he wants me to go off and film movies in Italy, you know, and he acts like a baby.
Yeah.
And I think this is where we get at this amazing dyad. Like, these two characters, the Brad Pitt and the DiCaprio characters, are like these incredible doubles of each other in this movie. And, you know, it's basically the beginning of the movie. It's totally early on where they have that little black and white interview that they're giving. Mm-hmm. Do you know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And this like journalist is like, I'm here on the set of, you know, whatever this Western is, here with Rick Dalton. And this is his stuntman, Cliff Booth. Let's talk to them. And they explain what a stuntman does. And basically what they're explaining is, I'm the one who looks like a hero, but I can't actually fall off the horse. I can't actually fight. I can't actually shoot a gun. It's this dude that you've never heard of.
And that is basically the fulcrum of which this film hinges on, isn't it?
Well, it's this really fascinating kind of thing about what's authentic and what's not authentic, yeah? And in the sense that, like, they have this funny power dynamic where they're buddies and they're friends, or they're kind of married to each other in this way, yeah? But actually, Cliff, as played by Brad Pitt, is DiCaprio's employee. Yeah. And there's this kind of power imbalance as well. Yeah. And I think when you rewatch the film, this dynamic between them is just like so subtly demonstrated. Even in that opening interview with that journalist on the set of the Western show, like, Brad Pitt has this like kind of, ironic dismissal that is underneath everything that he's saying as he looks at his so-called buddy, who's actually a star, who he probably thinks is a pansy-ass, mm-hmm. like, whiny boy. Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean? But actually, that's even too strong, because that would make him... That would make the Cliff Booth character seem like he's kind of more aggressive than he yeah. is. Cliff Booth is this guy who just exists, right? He is what he is, and he's Brad Pitt. And he exists with that body that he's so comfortable in and mm-hmm. he's so easy with. The hilarious irony of the movie is that Brad Pitt is the stuntman, the most movie star man who's ever existed since Paul Newman. That's the humor in it, yeah? Yeah. That's what I love about the kind of layers of interplay here in this film.
Yeah.
So
I like your take on this, Brian.
Okay, thanks.
Also, but I should say, you know, the power thing is that you are the stuntman and you're strong and you're gorgeous, but I'm the person who employs you.
Right.
Yeah. It does make them dependent on each other in a believable way.
As the film goes on, we see that Cliff, the Brad Pitt character, we're reaching the end of the time that they're going to be together. Mm. Because if you remember the plot line, like, there's not much plot to the movie as well. Like, we were sold on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood that it was going to be this telling of the Manson murders. And I expected it to be kind of following the Stations of the Cross as laid out by Carina Longworth in that epically long You Must Remember This series. And most of that is like completely avoided.
Yeah.
So the main long middle section of the movie is essentially one day where DiCaprio is on the set filming that Western thing. And he's just like, he doesn't know how to act.
Yeah.
He's like so tortured.
The reason he's dressed in going like, stuff, stuff,
stuff, stuff, yeah, stuff. But that's what I mean. And it's both, he plays that with such amazing irony. At the same time, it is both funny and kind of sad.
Yeah.
Like, you're kind of laughing, and then you're like, the fact that this guy cares so much about this stupid shit and thinks that this, like, cheap-ass disposable Western is his chance to be Marlon Brando is kind of funny. And his, like, conversation with that little girl, I think only Tarantino could get away with walking this, like, incredibly weird fine line between, like, sentiment and humor. So all that's going on with the DiCaprio
and
character.
And at the same time...
We
have probably... what is my favorite extended scene in contemporary cinema for the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is one of those incredible.
It's
one of those great Tarantino set pieces,
yeah.
which feels like a short film in itself. Yeah. I remember it from Inglourious Basterds as well. That scene in the tavern, like, literally could be its own short film. And I think you're talking about the Spawn Ranch scene.
Oh, I am, indeed.
Yeah. But again, like, okay... I'm just going to shout some moments from the movie for you to remember, because I've watched it more recently than you did. Brad Pitt picking up the girl.
Margaret Qualley,
better known as Andy McDowell Jr. He picks her up off the street. She's hitching and she wants to give him a blowjob.
Oh my God.
Do you remember them riding in the car?
Oh my God. I remember wanting to be that girl so much.
Well, of course you did. And of course she wants to give him a blowjob. But Pitt is incredible. On these subtle layers of charisma mixed with humanity, you can register from this character's face, I'd like a blowjob, I don't want to get in trouble, this girl is into me.
She's probably underage.
She's underage, I'm going to flirt, but I'm going to keep my cool.
Yeah.
And in that moment, you know everything you need to know about this character.
Yeah, also maybe he killed his wife.
Maybe he did kill his wife, everyone thinks he killed his wife, again we don't know. And that's again a thing where, like, woke Twitter is all up in arms, and you're like, the movie literally never says. And I think that the character of Cliff Booth, as played by Brad Pitt, is so full of an aura, so full of mystery to me. I think people forget how hard it is to be that easy in your own skin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know certainly anytime I've ever seen myself on video or photographed, I think, God, who is that person who's wearing a suit of human flesh? You know what I mean?
Do you remember what Mark Maron said on his podcast? And he was like, you know, every so often, you know, I meet people and it's all good. And then sometimes you meet people and it's like, oh, shit, you guys are movie stars.
Well, exactly. But Brad Pitt is a movie star, by which I mean he makes what he's been doing for so many decades look so easy.
He does, doesn't he?
And
even when it's bad.
If you think about how he's, you know, that performance in Thelma and Louise is extraordinary.
It's star-making.
It's extraordinary for what it is. But in a certain way, a lot of younger actors might have been able to do something like that. And then, you know, you have that period of time with, like, 12 Monkeys or Fight Club or wherever, where he's maybe pushing it a little bit too hard and he's trying to act a little bit too much. As he mellows into the last decade, with Moneyball, with Tree of Life, right? With some of the movies that he's been making recently. And also, frankly, the movies that he's been producing.
Yeah, of course.
Like, Brad Pitt is a mensch. All apologies to Jennifer and Angelina and Gwyneth and whoever else may know more than I do about what the man is like personally. But movie-going-wise, he's a mensch.
Yeah.
He's a mensch in terms of the roles he does, the projects that he gets behind. And this movie, which will without question win him a Best Supporting Actor Oscar, is so well-deserved. He embodies everything about male stardom. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to give you some other images to stick in your mind. Him hopping up the roof to fix the TV antenna.
Oh my God.
Taking off his shirt and listening. And then we flash back to that sequence where he's with Kurt Russell on the thing and he's fighting with Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But just that shot of him with his shirt off, you know?
Yeah. How do you think Tarantino says to him, it's like, okay, now Brad, today we're going to do the shot where you get up on the roof and you take your shirt off, you know? How do you think Brad Pitt feels? Like, he's in his 50s now. He's stunning at every age. But how do you think he feels when he takes off his shirt in a movie now? Does he think, my body tells a story? My body is a story.
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's clearly perfected how to do this, and it goes back to Thelma and Louise and A River Runs Through It and whatever other movies he's been mm-hmm. objectified. But, you know, I think the Academy's real mistake was not realizing that they could have had a pair of Best Supporting Actor and Actress winners in their 50s who are fucking smoking hot, and it could have been Brad Pitt and J-Lo.
Yeah, yeah.
It could literally have been the two most amazing human specimens that have ever existed.
Yeah, exactly. That's their loss, isn't it?
It really is. But just to kind of wrap this up about the film, like, it's funny and sad, and I think what I love and respect about both of them and the way that Tarantino constructs these characters is that he's not afraid to explore the humiliation of these characters as well. So that one day goes on, Pitt is kind of cluing in to the fact that something weird is going on Spawn Ranch. Do you remember his long extended interaction with Bruce Dern?
Oh my God, it was so good.
And Bruce Dern is just happy to be living with a bunch of sex-crazed hippies who, like, jerk him off all the time because he's a blind old man living in a weird deserted ranch. But Brad Pitt, again, conveys this kind of, like, humanity of, like, I'm worried about you, man, like, I'm worried about, like, the vibe of what's going on here. And yet everything is so beautifully controlled until they kind of come at him with the car. And then he unleashes this violence that he goes against that guy who punctures his tire. And you start to think, okay, despite being this easygoing, gorgeous, kind of laconic man, he kind of has this coiled intensity within him.
Mm.
And we jump ahead, if you remember, in the chronology. And DiCaprio goes off to Italy and he mm-hmm. films all those ludicrous spaghetti westerns. And he comes back overweight with an Italian wife. And because of the debts that he has now, he's got to drop Cliff. Like, Cliff is no longer going to be his employee. So that night of the Manson killings has this kind of, like, last hurrah quality for this, like, unit, this kind of male unit that's never been really a friendship. Mm-hmm. And they go out and they get trashed and they get drunk. And just, like, you know, watching the movie a second time, those last killings of the Manson killers, it's literally like the last 12 minutes of the movie. Like, there's so much more movie up until you get to that point. You remember they come home and they're making frozen margaritas and Brad's smoking an acid-laced cigarette. Yeah. And then just he's like, I'm tripping and I can't really understand what's going on here as these, like, crazy hippies are telling me that what they need to do now is kill everyone in order to, like, bring about the reign of Satan and, like, start a race war.
Yeah.
I did have problems with the end of the movie the first time I saw it, but I like to think that what it's building up to is this moment where, like, Brad literally does all the work of killing those hippies until the end when DiCaprio, who's been floating in the pool with his jug of margaritas, like, literally just takes out a flamethrower and, like, incinerates the last one.
Yeah.
And then who gets the credit for it? Who gets to meet Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring? It's DiCaprio. And Brad, who's been slightly injured, has that goodbye shot where he, like, sails off in the back of the ambulance. And you're like, goodbye, Cliff Booth. You were a
goodbye
movie
forever.
You were a movie star, was never a movie star. This man is going to forget you. You're one of the endless chain of people who've, like, come to Hollywood and is, like, disappearing into obscurity. And there's a gesture in the movie that's so interesting about, like, how we retain images versus how we retain reality. Because obviously, in real life, Jay Sebring and Sharon Tate were destroyed, right? And we have the, like, tender image of her, like, preserved in the film in that forgettable comedy that she's in that Margot Robbie goes to see. So this is one of the ways in which Tarantino's gesture of, like, changing the outcome of history, for me, has a really powerful meaning here. It's just saying, like, let's preserve the images that we want to preserve. I don't know. I'm still of two minds about it, because obviously that, you know, we do watch Brad Pitt, like, brutally destroy a couple of, like, young seeming girls, but I guess you have to, like, register on some double level that they are about to commit brutal murders of all these other people, and it's just
one of the most horrific murders of all time.
Yeah. So, sorry I've gone on for a while, but have I made the case for you for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
You have, Brian.
Have yes, I?
You have.
It's a masterpiece. It's my second favorite Tarantino movie, and I'm going to be honest with you, I wouldn't be sad if it won Best Picture.
Cool. This is good. This is interesting. There are a couple of films we'd be happy if they won. Anyway, time for a break.
It was at this point, having spoken for more than an hour, that Sean and I decided we ought to split this episode into two parts. So have a look in your podcast feed tomorrow for the rest of the conversation. And I guess for now, we ought to do something else, like take a break. Right, Sean?
Let's actually take a break. Let's put in some music to that point. I like you a lot, lot. All we want is her.